Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. Today's a very special episode because it features Nick Smart. Well, I guess every episode's special, but Nick's the head of jazz at the Royal Academy, so he's kind of like, if we could have a jazz Dumbledore, I guess it would be Nick. I am your host, Rob Cope, and I think Dan's away on holiday. I think he's in the Lake District because I've texted him and had no reply. So these gaps where Dan would normally speak, there shall be no words. I hope you've been enjoying. We've been throwing out a plethora of album preview shows. I hope that's the right use of the word plethora. There's loads of albums coming out. I thought the album preview shows would be a great monthly thing, but then what's happened at the moment, of course, is there's loads of music being released and some months is quite quiet. So we'll just chuck out as many as we possibly can in the space that we have. This almost marks the end of the Summer of the Jazz podcast. The Summer of the Jazz podcast was an episode every single week for as long as possible, but probably September there'll be, well, still plenty of shows. There's just so many people to talk to. It's hard to stop. All right. So without further ado, let's talk to Nick. My God, Nick Smart, welcome for the third time to the Jazz podcast. This time I'm recording the interview. So tell us about your parents.
Yeah, well, my dad was a opera singer, but not really professionally until much later when he was quite well known as a teacher. But he started out as did national service and all of that. You know, he was born in 1931, and then he was in kind of show business in 60s in London.
Do you know what he did in the National Service?
He was in the Rifle Brigade, maybe.
Right. What years would they have been?
Late 40s, early 50s, I guess.
Yeah.
But anyway, he had this sort of passion for singing and went into London. He was in choruses with Harry Secombe. What was that show he did? There was one called Pickwick, and he did one with Tommy Steele, but just in the choruses. But it's very funny for me now as a, you know, jazz musician and doing, like last week, doing Ronnie's or something and thinking of him there in the clubs. Because he also sang in, like, strip clubs and stuff. You know, they'd have a band.
Yeah.
And he did a long one at Raymond Review Bar.
Mm-hmm.
And he once took his friend down to... he didn't tell him why, but he said, "Oh, follow me." And they went down to Soho, and there was a massive sort of 10-foot high picture of my dad sat on the chair with a naked sort of girl dancer on each knee, and he just pointed up at the picture, and they were completely cracking up. But I've never seen it, but it must exist somewhere in that picture. But it's funny, you think now, well, people like Bobby Wellens did some of those gigs, so they're, you know, those two
they
worlds
must have been in the same place.
Yeah, yeah, you know, but it obviously never happened. And the thing about my mum's a really good piano player. She went to Trinity and then was just a music teacher, mm-hmm. and didn't, you know, play it as a living or anything. But we had loads of sort of show music, and you know, Dad used to sing in some sort of Amdram things and stuff like that. So whilst it wasn't really a jazz upbringing, it was very kind of melodic, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, it was lots of songs from shows and things like that. So, yeah.
Incidentally, John Ormston is the only musician I know who has done a gig in a strip club.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. And that's just one of those things where you're like, that's just John's life.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I never get those gigs.
No, I don't think I have. No, there must be more, though.
Yeah. So, how did you get introduced to the trumpet?
Well, I remember in the village, I grew up in Toddington, which is just off the M1, where the service station is, you know.
Like the last one before London, I think that one is. At least to me. Or is first
kind.
Time? Yeah,
I think there may be, yeah. But
it's quite nice services.
Yeah, well, it was
the car park.
Yeah, it was a formative arena for me. Because they, I mean, this is unbelievable, but they used to have... My mum had a friend that worked at Toddington Services and could get a 10% discount in the shop. And so some of my first jazz, like, purchases were from Toddington Services.
Wow.
Honest to God, you could buy... It's still one of my favourite albums. There's a Louis Armstrong record called Satch Plays Fats, and it's playing all Fats Waller tunes. And
yeah.
It's an incredible record. And I got that on cassette in Toddington Service Station. And not only that... But because I was playing in brass bands and things, there were like best of, you know, Grimethorpe Colliery band cassettes and best of the big band sort of cassettes,
yeah,
and things like that. I'm sure I got like Kind of Blue in there on cassette and things as well. I mean,
wow.
It's, can you imagine now going in buying Will Vincent's new album at Leicester Forest East?
Oh, man.
But anyway, sorry, I digress.
No.
In the village, they always had like a Remembrance Sunday thing, and I remember a girl cornet player playing the last post and kind of being interested in that. So she was my first teacher, I think, even lent me a cornet when...
Oh, wow.
Must have been about eight or
that
something.
That was it? You were just like, I want to try that?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't any, like, ferocious sort of hunger to play, you know. But I just was sort of captivated by it to some extent. But the kind of real passion for it came later, you know.
Yeah. So, when... Do you remember, actually, the time in your life when that... Like, what were you into when you were, like, a teenager?
Well... As in, like, playing in the brass bands and things, I never did orchestral playing, which I regret. I remember going to Luton Symphony Orchestra, and to my shame, but I have to admit it's the truth, that I was just bored by the amount of rests, the trumpet. I know that's just a completely heathen thing to say.
It's a good reason to become a jazz trumpet player.
Well, it was just, I was an idiot and very young, and that was honestly how I felt, having come from like concert wind bands and brass bands, and to a lesser extent big bands, where you're playing all the time, and you always get the tune and all that, you know.
Well, I think it's easy to underestimate the amount of discipline it takes to be a, you know, I did a few like orchestral saxophone gigs when I was younger, and and on the saxophone, like, you can't even believe you're in there, and then play maybe, I mean, like, Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances is one of the saxophone's like key repertoire things, and it's like 32 bars in a four movement symphony, you know, it's just, and then you just sit there. Still, like,
plenty of time to get really nervous before you're
and you can't leave afterwards either.
No.
There's no like nip to the bar.
No, exactly. It's not like a pit gig, is it? Right, I'm done. See you later.
Yeah, see you at the pub.
Wow, yeah. But no, I was into like brass bands and wind bands and things, but there was an amazing thing that, again, you just can't imagine now, as well as being able to buy jazz cassettes in Toddington Services. Toddington at one point had the most pubs for a village of its size.
Wow.
And I think there were eight pubs, but there was one pub called The Angel, and that had jazz eight sessions a week, like as much as the 606 or something. I mean, it was every single night and Sunday lunchtimes. And Sunday lunchtimes used to be Jimmy Skidmore, you know, Alan Skidmore's father. And there were big bands and Dixieland nights and kind of what they call modern jazz nights. But the owner of the pub was a trumpet player called Keith Baldwin. And he gave me my first sort of Amos Old play-alongs and some kind of jazz lessons.
Yeah.
He was very much a kind of, oh, you'll hear it, kind of a teacher. But nevertheless, it got me in. And it massively, obviously, sorted out my big band reading. Because I was like 15 playing... in quite a lot of big bands every night. Nothing glamorous. They're all just local sort of blow bands.
Yeah.
But just the amount of experience reading charts and taking the odd little solo, you know. So it was from that. And the music department at the school, Harlington Upper School, was also really good. And crucially for me, and I still believe this to this day, was that it was social. So you'd look forward to getting together with everyone, and you'd practice your parts and be as good as you could be because you were playing with your mates.
Yeah.
And you didn't want to let them down. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that's still kind of a motivation now, isn't it, when we play with friends and with your mates groups and things.
Yeah,
you know, it's obviously a selfish thing that you want to sound good yourself, but it's for everybody else as well, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. So can you remember deciding that you were going to be a trumpet player, like,
no,
you know, for a living?
I mean, it's not a secret, but not a lot of people know or can imagine. But did you know I was in the Royal Marines?
I did know that. I always had this innate fear that you might snap any moment.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't be very impressive if I did.
Well, you're just such a... You're a very friendly, warm-hearted guy, and so...
You.
Yeah. If ever I'd be like, you'd be like, wow, I can't really imagine, you know?
Yeah.
It seems like a different...
But the crucial thing was, and I mean this with absolutely no disrespect at all, but I had some wonderful teachers and people who really kind of inspired me and gave me a load of time. But they'd either come from military music backgrounds or gone from kind of conservatoire music college straight into peripatetic teaching, so their sort of vision of the world was that you can't really be a professional musician. There's it's such a rarefied ambition, and to be frank, I wasn't amazing at all. I mean, I was fine. I was like the third or fourth best trumpet player in Bedfordshire.
Yeah.
But I wasn't amazing by any stretch, you know.
Yeah.
And so they were probably just thinking for me, well, you got no chance. I'd suggest them the military if you want to play, because at least you'll get a salary.
And right.
I was kind of, well, if I'm going to do that, I want to do the best one. And
so that's why you.
That's why I went in the Marines, and I really, it wasn't for me, you know.
How long were you in it for?
A year. I did all the basic training, like all the military training, and. They had this old thing, the system used to be that you could either be solo cornet or cornet and piano.
Yeah.
And they said I could have the solo cornet thing, but one of the people and a few friends advised, well, if they'll take you on cornet and piano, you may as well do that because you'll learn the piano for free. You know, you'll get lessons on the piano.
Yeah.
But anyway, turned out I was too rubbish at the piano to succeed, and there were all the military sort of cutbacks at the time,
right?
And basically it was agreed, my discharge sheet, which has been true for many of the bands I've played in, says services no longer required. and that was it. And luckily my mum was a hero, and I had this sort of deferred place at Salford Uni on the kind of band musicianship, BAND, not BANNED.
Yeah.
And that was, which there were sort of jazz pathways within it, but she'd, without me knowing, she'd kind of been telling him, he'll be coming in September, you know.
Oh, wow.
And I'd signed up for 22 years, you know. I thought I was done.
My God.
So I went to Salford.
That's weird, you could still be in it now.
Well, I could be retired with a full pension now.
Oh,
more distressingly.
Yeah. So,
but no, of course.
What was the ratio of like military training and firing guns to trumpet playing?
Well, in basic training, I mean, like zero 95 trumpet. To yeah. 5. You know, we'd just have Saturday mornings. We'd go and sort of play instruments, but yeah, we did the full thing.
Do you like sleep in a tent or in like some barracks and get
what,
up?
What, still?
No, I'm sort of over in a house again.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah, we did all of that. Yeah. Yeah, it was funny. I mean, the musicians in the Marines, at least, you know, speaking for my time, I don't know about now, but it was more military training that than soldiers in the army would do. You know, we had we did like 30 weeks of it or something, you know. So, yeah, but it was good fun. I've still got a few friends there. And Gordon Campbell still teaches down at Portsmouth at the Marine School and keeps saying, I'll have to get you down.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It would be funny.
So how was Salford? How long were you there for?
That was a 3-year degree, and that was amazing for me.
There were some great people at Salford.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I studied in Manchester, and lots of my teachers had come from Salford Uni.
Who was that?
I'm thinking like Dave Hassel.
Oh, yeah, Dave was there, yeah. And there were an amazing sort of group of musicians around. Andy Schofield, Ian Dixon, Mike Walker, I think, was still teaching at Salford then. And my first trumpet teacher there has just passed away, which was very sad. And he was a really lovely bloke and a great teacher called Dave Browning.
Right.
And I had him for 2 years, and then just at the end of my second year and into my final year, I had Richard Isles, who was amazing.
Oh, cool.
And Richard was part of that group as well with Les Chisnell.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was incredible. I mean, for me, because I wasn't amazingly good or sort of confident, you know, and I still get nervous and things now. I have to keep working hard to stay on top of that. And I think if I'd have come straight to London, if I'd have even got a place anywhere, it may not have been the best thing for me.
Yeah.
And to go there and just find my feet. And I used to run the jam session at the Black Horse down the road from Salford. And
yeah,
we did a lot of gigs. And towards the end of, in like my last year, Dave Hassel put the Petos big band together. And
yeah.
Richard Isles would give me the odd dep in that. So, you know, I was kind of playing, you know,
yeah.
and starting to work, and would come down to London and do the odd Nijo thing. And really, thanks to that, I got a place onto the Guildhall postgrad, which was just a diploma then. And
was that a 1-year course?
It was just a 1-year thing. And it was one of the only postgrads in London. So it was a very common sort of pathway from Leeds College of Music and Salford to come down, you know, do the 1 year at Guildhall with Pete Churchill and Simon Purcell and Scott Stroman, and then be kind of in London. And
what made you want to come back down?
I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I guess I would have, even though I was working up there, I'm not sure I was earning enough to just think, okay, well, I'm done.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a good question. I guess psychologically I'd always imagined that's somewhere I am away at college. And the thing that you do when you finish college is go back to where you're from or something. But I can't remember why I did that.
Because now when I look back, when I moved to London, it was a wonderful thing. Because I just, like, my friends moved here. They were a year older than me, like Jack Davies, John Ormston, Tom Taylor. Mm. They all graduated a year early. They all moved to London. So when I finished, I didn't even think twice. I just you know, that was like you say, even though I actually am from Manchester, it's just like, well, that's what we're all doing then.
Yeah, right. You know? But yeah, mate, it wasn't like that for me because there weren't.
They started
paying
with Nadine Tamori, and I had to put a stop to that.
Oh, had they up there?
When they moved down here, and they were like, "Oh yeah, Nadim can debt for you in this, you know." I was like, "No, he can't. I better move now and put that
quite
out."
It's quite good.
Yeah,
astonishing musician. But it wasn't like that for me because there were. I wasn't part of a wave of friends moving down or anything, you know. So I don't know. Anyway, yeah.
Can we talk about performance anxiety a little bit? Because I've been really intrigued by how many guests we've had who have been really open about saying they still get really nervous before they play, that they still worry or think they're not good enough to be playing. And it's not something I really ever talked about, I guess, because I never really worried about it. But now I'm really interested because I think it's something that a lot of... I almost think that a lot of the musicians that I know maybe suffer it in relative silence. And I don't know why. Like, because it's not like a thing that's like a stigma to talk about. And yet lots of people do get it, who I'm surprised by when they tell me that they get performance anxiety.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say, but it's all it's an internal sort of battle, isn't it, that you face? And I guess you invest or associate a certain amount of self-worth with how you think you've played. And of course, the bottom line is, as a when you're a professional musician and above a certain line of ability or whatever, it's never really perceptible to the audience, is it? It's perhaps your other bandmates, if they know you really well, could tell if you're suffering. But I had it just the other night at Ronnie's. I had a real stinker, you know. It was doing JTQ, which I've done nearly 12 years, and I know all the music off by heart, of course.
Yeah.
And it can be absolutely fine. And then it's really stupid, like, self-centred stuff, but I just saw one musician there that wigged me out, you know. I thought, oh, well, he knows loads of trumpet players that would be better at this gig than I am. And
yeah,
you know what I mean? I know it's the dumbest thing, but suddenly you've just got this, you know, if you kind of imagine your brain like a computer CPU and one of those graphs of available space, you know, going up there. And there's like, you know, 75% of your available headspace that could be going into the music just obsessing about this completely unhelpful thing.
Yeah.
But it's extremely hard to turn it off.
Yeah, I only get it with my teachers, with like Andy Scott particularly, because he taught me for such a long time. Then I came to London to like fly the nest and, you know, study here. And I feel now like it's easy to be playing and be like, God, I should be better than this. Or maybe he's expecting this amount of level. You know, it's really hard not to constantly imagine how he's like perceiving your ability and what you can do and how it must sound to his ears.
But that, I think that's quite a common one, isn't it? For like, if you think of certain performance anxieties having triggers, and triggers could be things like it being recorded or broadcast that kind of turns on your nerves, or certain people being in the audience and that or a certain difficult piece or something or tempos. But and I think having your ex teachers around is probably one.
I saw him play at the Manchester Jazz Festival a few weeks ago and he made a couple of mistakes and I was thrilled. I was like, yes, you, Andy.
Well, that flies in the face of what I was going to say. I remember talking to Guy Barker about it once when I was at college, and he sort of just said this really simple thing of like, no one wants you to make mistakes. Like, no one is watching, willing you to cock up, you know. And that kind of made me think, oh yeah, well, I suppose that's true. That was kind of dumb, thinking that they're all there like rubbing their hands waiting for you to go,
like I do.
You know. But it turns out there are some people.
Oh man. So when you finished Guildhall, were you living at home or were you like living in town?
No, I was in London with you know Simon Colum, the piano player?
No, I don't know
him. Me and Simon and the drummer Buster Birch, we all lived together above an off licence in Hackney.
Oh, wow.
Liam Noble was just round the corner as well with Simon Thorpe. And I used to spend a lot of time, a lot of late nights sort of listening to music with Liam and Phil and Christine. They were very special times for me and special people for me and still are, you know?
Yeah.
That was like a serious education, really. You know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, I was just teaching, and there was a thing that I just taught on again the other week, but Simon Purcell used to run it with Dave Wickens, called the Glamorgan Summer School.
Yeah.
You know about that?
Yeah.
Dave Hassell used to do it, and they showed me the list the other day. Someone had, like, the teacher list and there was some people sadly no longer with us, like Pete Sabaton and Bobby Wellens, but there was like Julian Arguelles, Sabo and Bobby, and Jeff Simpkins and Liam Noble, and like the talent, you know, the sort of quality of teachers on it. Steve Buckley used to do it sometimes, and Chris Batchelor, who was really important, and Simon used to get me on, get me to do that as a as an assistant tutor,
right?
And I think that was, looking back now, that was sort of a significant little shift in my teaching kind of
right
trajectory, or yeah, or something, you yeah know. And then I got some depths at Middlesex through Nicky and Chris
at the university,
yeah, and Rob Townsend,
yeah,
who I know well, and we do JTQ together. So yeah, kind of, you know, that meant then that thing of just doing school teaching slowly kind of picked up to
yeah
to having a bit more to do at a higher level, you know.
Yeah. Were you doing many like performing projects or other people's bands? Did you ever make much money out of playing?
Yeah, I did this big world tour with like a pop group that was really the maddest sort of fortuitous thing. That there's one of my very old trumpet friends called Ben Edwards. He's a brilliant bloke and a great player. And he asked me to go and do this recording session in Wales. I think Tom Allen, you know Tom, the trumpet player?
Yeah.
I think he was supposed to do it and couldn't right do it, so I did it. And we had to go to Wales to record this Blues Brothers, like kids' Blues Brothers play-along
yeah
CD. So, and I saw it once. It was like all Minnie the Moocher, and it was like a little kid's clarinet book, and we were the backing band on the CD. And it turned out that the people doing that recording were involved with the band Spiritualized, and they just liked our vibe because we were all friends, you know. They thought it was nice atmosphere or something, and that was it. They said, okay, come and can you do the Spiritualized album, which was a huge production at Abbey. He was in Abbey Road for about a year doing this record called Let It Come Down. It's got a sort of CD case with a 3D cutout of a girl's face with pigtails and stuff. Yeah. It was quite a big album. And he had one of the big orchestras on it, the Swingle Singers on it, the London Community Gospel Choir,
yeah,
and then us as a horn section.
Oh, cool.
And then we did a world tour, you know, like
yeah
all the TV shows, the Tonight Show with Jay Leno in Los Angeles.
Sweet.
And Top of the Pops and Jules Holland, and we did all of that. It was a great one. Anyway, like all these things, it comes to an end. And when it did come to an end, we were doing Top of the Pops for the second time, and he had this tune called what was it like? Nothing hurts you like. Oh, I can't remember. But anyway, it had a bit of woodwind on it and
yeah
stuff. So it was, you know, there was the sort of trace elements of orchestral stuff. So somebody in their wisdom hired a bassoon, because we were right miming anyway,
yeah,
and brought this bassoon in and said, will you play bassoon? And me and some of the others were a bit self-important,
yeah,
and snooty. Like, no, I'm going to be on television. I'm
yeah
not going to play.
Yeah,
you know, this is my business, my
yeah
trumpet playing. And but Jimmy Adams, you know, James and trombone player, is a brilliant guy. He's just like, yeah, I'll do it. I don't care. And so he proceeded to stand in the horn section and hold the bassoon horizontally like a giant flute across, like obscuring, and I think that's on YouTube.
Wow.
Somewhere. And then after that, we were they scaled it back.
You yeah
know, that, wow, that was the end of that.
That's
it was
incredible.
Very funny. Yeah,
yeah.
We did a record. The last one we did with them, Evan Parker and Kenny Wheeler played on as well.
Oh, wow.
As because they were all interested in sort of free improv. The guitarist and the DJ who came on the road supporting the band were the duo Ashley and John that make up Spring Heel Jack.
Right.
And they did projects with Matthew Shipp and William Parker and John Chakai, and I mean, some incredible stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Evan and all that.
Can you, and you might not be able to, but can you pinpoint a time that you could consider like the most formative years of your kind of musical development?
I'm hoping they'll come pretty soon, because I'm getting on a bit.
Any day now.
Yeah, yeah, honestly, I can feel it coming any day now. Yeah, I mean, that period after, I mean, of course, college, you know, I'm never into that thing of, oh, I didn't learn anything at college. Mm-hmm. That always does my head in when people say that.
Yeah.
But you're, so of course, being involved in that was important. But yeah, the period afterwards, being with Liam and Phil and Christine and on those sort of first Glamorgans, that was important, without a doubt. And frankly, to be honest, even now, it really is true that old kind of saying of the more you know, the more you know you don't know.
Yeah.
And I, you know, when we have these amazing people like Dave Holland or something coming into the academy and he says, oh, I still consider myself a student and I'm as interested in what you're doing as you are in what I'm doing.
Yeah.
It's not some kind of jive, you know, fake thing to say. I think he genuinely means that, and I get that, you know. There's so many amazing things going on in the music now that I certainly feel more sort of urgent than ever to get it together.
You know?
Not just jazz either, on the trumpet. I mean, I've been really, like, moved and inspired by the kinds of things that Tom Walsh has done, and I love Tom, and to get that, you know, to be, it's kind of, Facebook is a mixed blessing, isn't it?
Yeah.
To be in a position where somebody like Tom could have Jerry Hay responding and Wayne Bergeron responding to their Facebook, I mean, that's extraordinary. Imagine if we were growing up, you know, and Thomas Stanko would comment on one of your records. I mean, it was just like unheard of that, to be in touch with those people. And Tom and Louis Downswell, and James Copas, what they're doing on the instruments, like taking it so seriously.
Yeah.
I think it's amazing. So, no, I feel kind of hungrier than ever, but just have less time than ever is the downside. You know?
When I was when I was studying here, we used to have, I'm sure it still is on a Friday morning, World Rhythms.
Rhythmic Skills. Yeah.
With Barak Shmuel. But Stan used to come in and do the classes. Stan Saltzman, every week, every Friday, he'd be there just like everyone else. And he'd just be like, you know, just like, I'm really curious about what you guys are up to. I don't want to miss on out on anything. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I remember that.
That was a very valuable life lesson. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, and you still get it now, don't you, sometimes at certain masterclasses or things, like Larry Golding's trio was in, and quite a few people, John Parricelli and Martin France, and you know, all sort of sat there listening. And, it was amazing. Yeah.
One of the most special memories of my whole, I want to say education, but maybe life as well, was Kenny's, I think it was his 85th birthday, when there was a gig at the RNCM. I was still an RNCM student at this point. And Kenny did a masterclass in the Opera Theatre, and all the RNCM big band students came, and all of Kenny's big band came. So, like, you're there, Evan's there, Stan's there.
That was 2011, was it, or 10, like, late 2010?
It would have been, it would have to be for me to still be there.
Yeah, it was his 80th.
Maybe I was at Academy then.
80th.
80th. I don't know, but it was a lovely mix, and like loads of Academy people and Northern. But seeing Pete sitting
there,
in on
right?
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was conducting the band.
That was the 80th birthday, yeah. Yeah, that was incredible.
And like watching Evan Parker sitting and listening, and John Taylor was sitting at the piano, you know, and it was a remarkable thing for me to see that the guys in the band have exactly the same level of interest as I do, and I'm a student, and I've never met Kenny before, and these guys are in his band, but nobody's wasting the chance to sit and chat, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, yeah, everyone was genuinely interested. And probably it would have been an element of, because he was so quiet, you know, there were probably some of the people who knew him, had known him longer, thinking, what's he going to say? You
know, yeah.
He never says anything.
I witnessed a wonderful little conversation between John Taylor and Evan.
Oh, yeah.
And John was talking about how he feels very free to improvise over Kenny's music, having played it for years. And Evan was saying that he'd always felt very free because he loves to play freely, and his sort of life's ambition was to come the other way and be able to like read some minims. They were like meeting in the middle after a career each,
yes,
at opposite ends of the spectrum.
But no, it was, that was an amazing privilege, of course, to do that band. Yeah, I remember Derek Watkins speaking of performance anxiety earlier. This is pure conjecture. I don't know if this is what was going on or not, but it's a great story. When the very first time I played in Kenny's big band was for his 80th birthday concert in the Duke's Hall at the Academy, when we did the Sweet Time Suite in the second half, and we were stood backstage about to go on, and Derek goes to me, I didn't know well, but he said to me, "Don't be nervous, this is the band everybody wants to be in." And I thought, there's two things about that. Of A, like, wow, that's probably true, actually.
Yeah.
You know, who can you imagine, of most people, if they got that phone call, like, "Hey, would you like to come and do this tour with Kenny Wheeler's big band?"
Yeah.
But it was kind of an iconic group, you know. And I think that alone was true. But I also, something occurred to me of, like, I'm not nervous. I got the impression, like, I'm not sure you're saying that for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it was something he was getting or saying out loud to kind of put himself in a different place of, like, well, I'm looking after you because I'm the more senior, and it would make him feel better. It was a completely friendly thing he was doing. It wasn't vibey at all.
Yeah.
But I just wonder if there's a bit of you saying that for yourself as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I know he was not known to be nervous or that kind of thing, but it can't have been easy. You know, it was a hell of a sort of crown he carried.
Yeah.
I remember on that tour, I'm rambling now, but there were definitely times that people would be coming to the gigs to see Derek Watkins as much as they were Kenny Wheeler, you know. It wasn't someone you could easily go and see outside of a show or a studio or whatever.
Whenever I look at the cover of the Music for Large and Small Ensembles, you know, you look at the names, you're like, my God, it's a great thing, because it's really, there's just so many remarkable individual musical personalities on that CD, and yet it works. It's coherent, you know, and it probably shouldn't be.
Yeah, well, me and my friend Brian Shaw are writing Kenny's biography at the moment, and the period I'm sort of buried in is the early 70s, when he really starts to get his own big band together.
Right.
And there's that record called Song for Someone in 73. Which is, I remember John Taylor telling me that he thought that was probably the most significant album, because it was the time Kenny really started writing for individual soloists rather than just for a big band, you know.
Yeah.
And it was, and that aspect of it, you know, of a sort of a cliche, but it's true, that kind of Ellingtonian sort of ideal of writing for individuals was absolutely in there from the beginning. And actually, what I uncovered is that Song for Someone was really only just the record that happened to get recorded, but that all of the BBC broadcasts from that whole period Kenny was doing had those same people on and a lot of the same music on.
Yeah.
You know, so that really was just one snapshot of the time. But
he
kept that up his whole life, really.
Yeah. There's an album I found by accident. One of those great things when you're just like a kid and you're looking around for good music. And I can't remember if it was because of Kenny or because of Chris Potter, but the album What Now?
Oh, yeah.
I found with Kenny and Chris Potter, Dave Holland and John Taylor.
Yeah.
That was just like, that just changed my life forever. That little nugget, you know, just found it brilliant. On iTunes. Oh, what's this? And then I was like, shit.
Yeah, that got nominated for a Grammy, didn't it?
Did
that
it?
One? Yeah.
Wow.
I think that and Angel Song were the
two
that
awesome.
Got nominated for Grammys, which, interestingly, both the ones without drummers, you know. So there's a Chet Baker quote, isn't there? It says, you got to be a good drummer to be better than no drummer. I might have got that wrong, but I think it was him.
Oh, man. John Ormston used to warm up playing along to that Kenny album.
Did he?
Used to drive me nuts when we lived together. Because it was like, it's my favourite album, and they've already got Chris, you know, they don't need me.
Yeah.
But John would stick it on and happily play.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that and Angel Song, I should imagine. Dave Holland's so incredible on those things. It's like a one-man sort of orchestra, you know. It's got the rhythm, the harmonic interest, the rhythmic interest. Unbelievable.
Yeah, the time is so supreme.
Yeah.
Because John Taylor doesn't make it easy.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just so fluid, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was, in my experience anyway, it was never, ever, like, disruptive or whatever.
Yeah.
It was just so open, you know?
Yeah.
Remember that playing in that big band with John on piano? Just every bit of accompanying he did for the solos was just so supportive. When it was on his own solos, he could get pretty out and take much more risk, but the comping was unbelievably giving. You know what I mean? Like, really, was a very human kind of lesson in that.
So how is it? How did you feel when you were offered the job as head of jazz at the Royal Academy?
Well, it was of course amazing, I didn't know that was going to happen. There were interviews and all, you know, I had to apply for it and everything, because obviously I was involved anyway.
Yeah,
but I certainly didn't feel for a second like that it was a done deal or anything.
No, I came down that summer. I'd gotten a place and I was starting in a couple of months, I think.
Oh, so did you start in September 2010?
Yeah.
That was, then, because I...
And when I first came down here, there was just like, you know, everyone was in the hat, as it were, at that time, when no one knew who would have the job.
Yeah.
You know, and there was loads of people being talked about. But it always felt to me like you were overwhelmingly the best choice.
Oh, well, that's very nice of you to say. Best in my price range. Yeah.
Pay scale point one.
That joke. I mean, it's an outrageous privilege. Of course, you know, the quality of the students and the faculty and the visiting artists we get is just constantly sort of amazing, you know. So, nothing to say about that, really. Yeah. It is what it is, and I consider myself very lucky, you know.
Do the standards continually go up?
Yeah.
Roughly?
Yeah, they do. I mean, of course, there's always... You know, people like Gwillem and Kit Downs, and well, without leaving anyone out, there's been amazing.
Rob Cope
was astonishing.
Big time, yeah.
That's
how I remember it. Me being, you know, pretty much astonishing all over it.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, of course, there's always been amazing people. But the thing, just generally across the board, that level keeps going up.
Yeah.
I think so. But I was thinking about this earlier today, thinking we might talk about it. But I guess it is true to say that because the level of quality of teaching at younger age groups has improved so much.
Yeah.
Probably because so many super qualified people are leaving who can't get jobs at like higher education level. Yeah. So they're kind of ploughing that information and skill into the younger age groups. that it probably does mean that when we talk about standards now, there's kind of technical standards and artistic standards, almost as two separate things. And I think to get that, when you get that sense of real maturity in a young player, along with the technical thing, that's still pretty rare.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, but definitely. I'm still planning to be good when I'm like 55.
Yeah, you know? I think it's become harder. But it's not to take anything away. I don't think that is a bad thing. I just think that what's happened at younger age groups is that the amount of information that's available and being successfully sort of learned and internalized is going up and up and up, you know. And sometimes I think the effect of that is that people blame jazz education or say like, oh, everybody sounds the same and blah, blah, blah. When I don't really think that's true or...
No, I've got zero evidence to suggest
that's true. You just look at the scene now. And frankly, you've got to look pretty hard for people who didn't go to college amongst a certain generation. I know there's standout examples like most of Loose Tubes and like, you know, Mark Lockhart, Julian Arg.
Yeah.
I think none of them, John Paricelli didn't go. But you know, once you're down to like Liam and Julian Siegel and Phil and Christine and Gwillem and Kit and... That, you know, most people have had an education and still it hasn't kind of turned them into some sort of bebop cyborg, you know, which is the accusation, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of the music college thing. I think I'm quoting what Chris Montagu said in his show last week, that it's kind of replaced a more vibrant music scene where maybe 40 years ago there were tons of gigs and everyone could play more. And that's not quite the case ever so much now.
Yeah.
There's still places to play, but it's a little harder.
Yeah, I certainly think that's like our role is to try and make sure what the experience we're giving is as close to a preparation for a realistic future.
Yeah.
And that means dealing with like commercial work and writing and all of that kind of thing, and not just being in some sort of weird artsy ivory tower, you know, that doesn't really help, you know.
Yeah.
Because you got to be able to survive. And I think to bring it back to Kenny Wheeler, that he could do it all, you know, he could do sessions and he did arrangements of Elton John songs and James Taylor songs for Maynard Ferguson, and he could really survive. And same with a lot of the, you know, you think back to the great African American players like Dizzy or something. Dizzy could read and play in big bands, and you know, he would have been somebody that was, or Quincy Jones or Thad Jones, that actually they could work, they could earn a living, you know.
I have you to thank for making me learn the bass clarinet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the very first big band project I did.
What was it?
It was a trombonist, Dave Haller.
Oh, Dave Haller and Julian Arguelles. We did the together, right?
Yeah, and there were loads of bass clarinet parts.
Yeah.
And you were just like, Rob,
you're doing that.
Love the bass clarinet. And I was like, brilliant. You know, and of course, that was like, that's stood me in good stead for being able to earn a living, because it's another horn to your name.
Or was it Dave Haller and Tony Coe?
Do you know what? It might have been only Dave. I feel like Dave was, but maybe I've made that up. Oh, I have a good feeling, because I was really lucky that I wanted that bass clarinet thing, and originally I was put on tenor, but I took what I saw as a demotion to the Barry chair. Chance to play the bass clarinet, and then there was a big feature for Barry and trombone, which then fell to me.
Was that Stars Fell on Alabama or something like a Brookmeyer-y type?
Some incredible fortune had bestowed upon me for that decision, and I ended up doing something far
more. I tell you what, though, that thing about you do this, like learn the bass clarinet, that is amazing here with the projects that we do, that I never really consider that something will go wrong.
Yeah.
And they never, ever fail to deliver. And that's remarkable. Yeah. Like the last year we did that big concert at Cadogan Hall for Norma Winston's 75th with the full orchestra and like a big band within the orchestra.
Yeah.
Like a real kind of radio NDR type of a, you know, or Metropole sort of a scale of a project.
Yeah.
And it, and I just had absolute faith, well, it'll be fine, because it has to be fine.
Yeah.
But it will be because of their ability. And sure enough, they never, ever fail to deliver. It's amazing, you know.
I think there was an element with us of you wondering if I'd played it before, and I was kind of like, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
And I kind of figured it would be, and then the first few times I tried to play it, I just couldn't get any sounds out of it. But then, like you say, I felt like I'd been handed this, like the musical equivalent of like a newborn child, you know? Right. It's like, in comes this project, go away and figure out some notes. There was that, I would have done anything.
Yeah.
You know?
To tame the goose.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, no, it's great. I think everyone loves a challenge, you know, to be given a gauntlet and then see if you can figure it out in time. Nothing ever went wrong when I was here in that regard.
No.
Your album that you did, the like Nick Drake album.
Oh yeah.
Was that your first album?
Yeah.
What made you choose that Nick Drake would be the thing?
Well, the male singer, the bloke on there called Nick Mayling.
Yeah.
He's one of my oldest friends from school. And I used to have a brass quintet I ran called Brass Quintet with Drums called Five Brass Knobs and a Knocker, which I'm still incredibly proud of. And Nick played tuba in that, but then was like a rock star kind of a guy and everything. But Nick was one of my oldest best friends and still is. And he was telling me about Nick Drake, saying, oh, he was telling me all the sort of stories about how he was as a personality. And that kind of captured my imagination somehow. And I got into listening to him and really loved it. I have to say, this was nothing to do with, you know, people like Brad Meldow covering his songs, or I wasn't aware of any of that.
Yeah.
I just liked it. And in a way, it is still connected to the sort of nerves confidence thing, in that I never really thought for a second that anybody would be remotely interested in like a Nick Smart album, you know.
Yeah.
I just thought, well, who's going to care about that?
Yeah.
So it was a way of putting something else to the foreground that I could speak about with sort of passion and enthusiasm that would be difficult to do about myself, you know.
Yeah.
And Nick had a studio at the time in Bedford, and so it was also an excuse to do something with him.
Yeah.
Like the last record I did with my Cuban friends, that was people driven. It was like, I want to do something with them. I've known them a long time and I love them and what they bring to music. And and so it was the same with Nick. And then, I mean, thanks to the Glamorgan thing, I knew John Parricelli and Stan a little and Dave Hassel and Paul Clarvis, and of course was friends with Christine Tobin. And so no, it was a real labour of love that we just quietly, it's the sort of thing I couldn't do now really, because I wouldn't have time, but we just quietly chipped away at it over about 2 years. And then I did a big Arts Council tour, and it seemed to get noticed because the Jazzwise 20th anniversary in March, just a few months ago, John Newey asked me to put that put like a new version of the band together to do at Ronnie's at their kind of celebration thing. So we did it with Kit Downs and James Allsop, Matthew Hurd, still with John Paricelli, and Tim Giles played drums. And we've got another one actually next year in March, April, at the reopening of St. George's Theatre, which was one of the places we played originally in Bristol. So yeah, it's funny how you do these things and they kind of stick around.
Is there anything else coming up?
For me?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm off next week to, I don't know when this goes out, but at the end of August, early September, there's this four-day festival in John Taylor's memory in Ambleside.
Yeah.
And I'm going up to, because I want to hear a lot of it, but I'm going to play on a Sunday night with, there's an evening called Dave Holland with Friends or something.
Oh, great.
I think he'll do a solo thing and a duo with Norma and gradually add more musicians, you know. To right at the end, they'll let me on to sweep up. I'll do that, and then it's into the new term. I'm doing Michael Gibbs's 80th birthday big band tour, which will be amazing. And then my friend, the Irish bass player and composer Ronan Guilfoyle, has written a piece for Dave Liebman and Richie Byrack, their sort of 70th birthday, and I'm playing on that in Dublin.
Oh, cool.
And then flying back with Dave and Richie, and they're here in college for a few days. Brilliant. And then, so there's lots on. There's these French musicians I love that people should check out if they haven't heard them. I've had them over to London a few times, but they're called Benoit Cerise and André Charlier.
Right.
And the duos, like Charlier-Cerise. And they're just unbelievable musicians, and they play with some incredible players in France and everywhere. You know, I've done things with Kenny Garrett and Kurt Rosenwinkel, and terrifyingly for me, they're often with Alex Sipiaghi and all this incredible French trumpet player called Claude Egier. They're all people. It's sad, really, because it's so close. You know, if you think Paris is it's nothing now in terms of distance. Yet we don't know, those names mean nothing to us, but someone like Claude or Stéphane Guillaume, the saxophone player, you ever heard of him?
No.
He'd be like or as well known over here as our biggest sort of, you know, Ian Ballamy's or Julian Arguelles's and Stan Saltzman, you know, anything like that. But we haven't heard of them at all.
No.
It seems such a shame, you know. Yeah, now with everything with Brexit and all that, God knows what. It's not going to get any better, is it?
No.
But I've got 2 weeks in China with Benoit and André next year, which will be amazing as well. And I'll see some exotic bird life, which isn't sexual. Yeah. You know, I'm actually into actual birds.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
That's a jazz podcast exclusive.
That is.
Except it isn't really, because I went bird watching with Maria Schneider in South Africa. Which sounds like the beginning of a joke, but it's absolutely true.
That's great.
And then she outed me in Cadogan Hall in front of everyone, said, are there any bird watchers here? I know Nick Smart's here. And then everyone came up to me afterwards.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah, just like how you wanted that to go down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I like it.
Well, Nick, thanks so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast.
Thanks for having me. And thank you for all you're doing, like keeping all this together.
Thanks for checking out the Jazz Podcast. Next week is Camilla George, and we'll have an album preview show for the Brass Funkies' new album, Rabble Rouser. We hope you have a pleasant week, and I'll see you on Tuesday if album preview shows are your kind of thing. Otherwise, I'll see you back on the main stage on Friday.